I'm fantasy author L. Penelope, and welcome to My Imaginary Friends, a look behind the scenes of an author mapping the worlds in my head and making them a reality. Hello, friends. Today is Sunday, September 15th, 2019, and this is episode 32 of My Imaginary Friends. I'm Leslie. So I am just back from the StoryGrid Live conference, mini conference, I guess, event, the StoryGrid Live event. And it was in Franklin, Tennessee, just outside of Nashville. And I had a great time. I met a lot of really great people. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. But first, I want to get to this week's best thing, which was The Boys on Amazon Prime. I really enjoyed the show, The Boys. It's about a world where there are superheroes, but the superheroes are not necessarily the good guys. It's like, imagine if you had real life superheroes who were celebrities and almost deities, sort of. They were at the top of the stratum, and there was a corporation who was controlling them and making money off of them, off of licensing and movies and amusement parks and t-shirts and cereal boxes. And like real celebrities, these people are kind of jerks, and like worse than that. So I liked the show. I didn't love it, but I really enjoyed it. And it is gory. Now it's the type of gore that I don't mind. Like I'm not into gory at all, but the sort of comic book, like Quentin Tarantino gore. I don't know if that's really comic bookish. Not like Saw. Like I can't watch torture porn style gore, but when it's like in the first episode of The Boys, there's this super fast character like The Flash called A-Train who literally runs through a woman and her body just like explodes into blood and like body parts. And it's, I wouldn't call it cartoonish because it actually is sort of anatomically realistic, I guess, but it's still comic bookish. And so that it doesn't feel like it assaults my sensibilities and makes me cringe and gross out. It's heightened enough. And it's hard to explain. Like there's a certain type of super violent goriness that I don't mind. And this show has it, but a lot of people, it's not going to be for a lot of people, I'm sure. So they'll give you that caveat. If you can't take any kind of gore, because every episode, there's only one scene where I actually had to close my eyes and I was like, okay, no, that's too much. But for the rest of the episodes, and this was a scene in the bathroom in the subway, for anyone wondering. Yes, so I enjoyed it. I thought the writing was strong, but kind of predictable. Like I predicted all the major beats that were going to happen. But even with that, like a lot of times when I can predict things, I don't end up liking them. But even with that, like I predicted the surprise at the end, but it was still surprising, if that makes any sense. Like it was done well. I think it was really the characters that made me like the show because, even like the super bad people who are doing terrible, horrible things, they're showing you different sides of them. And, you know, there's some things I liked more than others, but overall, I do recommend the show if you can handle, you know, a little bit of gore. And I am actually excited to see what happens in the next season because they're going to have to raise the stakes and they've ended on a really conflict-filled, cliffhanger-ish type situation. So check it out. One other thing, though. They have, it's called The Boys, but there are, you know, women characters in it. And they have, you know, one character, the Asian woman who was in Suicide Squad, is mute throughout the whole thing. I don't think that's a spoiler. And kind of a little tired of like mute women, you know, who are super powerful and strong but can't speak. Like, that's a thing I could do without. And some of the other things that happened to the women, like I can see a guy writing this and thinking like, oh, wow, we're really doing something super empowering in terms of the comic book. And I know that they changed things from the original comic book. And from what I read, like, they were very good changes like that they made. And I know, and I did some reading on it afterwards, after I watched it. And so there are, you know, women writers and women directors all throughout. And so I didn't have a problem except for, you know, the mute woman trope. Is that a trope? It kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And I'm not a person who tries to find things that are wrong in everything that I consume, but that actually struck me. And I know that, you know, the more women you have in the writer's room and directing, those things are going to happen. I'm sure they're not going to you know, satisfy everybody. But I did think that the show had something interesting to say. And yeah, overall, still cool. So StoryGrid Live, I had decided to go because I talk about the StoryGrid all the time. It's the book, The StoryGrid, which has helped me in revision, and it's really an editing revision tool, but you can apply it to a certain degree to the beginning to plotting, because if you're thinking about these things ahead of time, if you're thinking about the structure of your global story and of your scenes and all of the elements of your story up front, then in theory, you know, I think the idea is you have less to do when you revise, but I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, there's always, revision is always going to be, at least for me, the way that I write with my process, it's always going to be intense. But I have found a lot of value in it. And so I wanted to go to this event when I got an email about it. And looking at my schedule for the next 2 months, a lot of these things came up after I decided to go. So it's very, very busy. If I had known then what I know now, I might not have gone. But I'm glad that I went. You know, I did get a lot out of it. I had some really good insights about just deepening understanding of the story grid and analyzing scenes. So my big takeaways, it's hard to summarize because Sean Coyne, who is the author, he was an editor in New York for a long time. He was an agent also. And then he started his own publishing house. And so after, you know, 3 decades editing, he created the system for editing and for kind of self-editing. And I think for also editors, because now they train StoryGrid certified editors and they have a whole kind of machine going on. So, but he is a very, his mind works in very unique ways. So I don't know that I'm going to be able to summarize what was going on there because he broke out Cartesian graphs and like it was like 150 people in the room. And he's giving these presentations and we're kind of all like staring slack-jawed at the things on the PowerPoint in like no comprehension. But then I think there was a time, because the people that I talked to, there's a time like maybe 3/4 of the way through the presentation when it started to click. And I talked to other people and they kind of had the same reaction where you've been staring at this for like, and tilting your head and like, what? And then you start to get what he's going for. And so he is bringing kind of a systematized way of approaching story and editing. But also he's very into the metaphysics and sort of a more woo-woo side of it. And one of the big takeaways that I got from the event was balancing that. Like he calls it toggling back and forth between algorithmic and heuristic, you know, between sort of the rules, quote unquote, you know, the rules that are laid out in this system of editing, and then also your intuition and the muse and just your creativity. And that's exactly how I approach things, kind of, you know, left brain, right brain, the way that it's traditionally understood. And so I think the biggest takeaway I can actually summarize that doesn't involve Cartesian graphs was about unexpected events. And, you know, like, when you're writing, they always talk about conflict and how conflict is so important. And a lot of times when you're first starting out, you know, you want to be nice to your characters and you have to learn to really put them through the ringer. But what does that even mean? Because you hear conflict and it's like, oh, every scene has to be fighting. And that's not what conflict is. I like Damon Swade's, the way he talks about it as friction, you know, because sometimes conflict can sound too intense. And when you think about it as friction, it helps me. And so thinking also about it as unexpected events, brought it into focus for me even more, where it's like you're just going along your day and something unexpected happens and you have to deal with that. And that's actually a conflict that's stopping you from the thing you thought was going to happen. And it's friction, all of those things, a million different ways of saying the same things and hearing them in different ways helps a lot. So he drilled down a lot deeper into this concept and had lots of, he's writing a book on cognitive science. And so that was kind of where the graphs and charts and higher level science as applied to story theory and mind blown, like lots of really interesting things. But I did begin to get it. And I think it'll still be sinking in. it sounds insane. Like it's really hard to describe. But there were a lot of great gems. And then the other part of the event that was super helpful were these breakout sessions where we would go into groups and they gave us scenes from different books that one was from an Agatha Christie novel, one was from The Talented Mr. Ripley, and one was from Ragtime. And as a group, we would sit and read the scene and then go through the story grid. And then there's questions that we would answer. And so whenever there's a system, I think that most people are trying to get the right answer. You know, so some of the questions were, what's the inciting incident of the scene? What are some progressive complications? What's the turning point? What is the crisis, the climax, the resolution? Those are the story grid elements. And the biggest takeaway from that for me is that very rarely did we agree on these things. You know, the whole point of it was to talk about it amongst ourselves, amongst our small groups, and give reasons why we thought this was the inciting incident versus that. And different people are going to have different ideas. And even to the point of the genre. Now, story grid genres are not the same as like marketing genres, but what type of story is this? And that goes into those other questions, you know, and there's disagreement on that. And I think what they were trying to show is that you don't have to agree. Like a different person with a different experience is going to bring something different to the scene. Like the last scene we read was Ragtime. It was from the book Ragtime. And I haven't read the book, but I've seen the musical because Audra McDonald was in it. But I didn't see her in it, but I've seen it. And I actually listen to that musical on Spotify all the time. And so I was the only Black person in my group. And it was a scene in which one of the main characters of Ragtime, who's this Black musician in, it's like the 1915-ish, I don't know exactly the year, but that era of America. And he's basically being harassed by these white people because he's got this Model T Ford and he's dressed all nice and he's a rich Negro and the white people are not having that. And so it's a short scene of the harassment that he goes through and his reaction to it. And so me coming at it, I'm seeing something a little bit different than I think the white people in my group were seeing from it. And so it's not always going to be, you know, race, but it's just whatever experiences you've had in your life, you're approaching a work very differently than anybody else will. And so, you know, there's some things that we're going to agree about and some things we're going to disagree about. But even to the point of what is the inciting incident in the scene, you're going to have different opinions on that. And so a lot of times when you're trying to apply some sort of methodology to your writing or your creativity, you're looking for the right way. And it was really helpful to go through these scenes with these people and realize there is no right way. And I think at the end of the session, it was kind of like, as long as you can identify these parts of a scene, a story, and have a reason for them and justify it, that's all it's about. Because it's not about agreeing. It's not about everybody getting the same thing out of a piece of art. It's just about when you're trying to make sure that you've constructed a scene that is working, that you have these elements. And good art is layered. And so because it's layered, different people are going to be able to find different things in it. And so that was a great lesson to walk away with. So yeah, I had a good time there. I learned a lot. I'm glad that I went. I found it valuable. I met some very interesting people. But there is one thing that I noticed at this event and that I've noticed before and that concerns me on behalf of others. It's the fact that there were a lot of either unpublished or underpublished writers there, people who were still, a lot of people struggling with their first manuscript. I met people who were self-published. And I think there were a lot of people who were, wherever step they were looking to take it to the next level. And I'm looking to always learn more craft. Like this was my craft-focused event for the year, as opposed to other things that I'm doing, which are more marketing-focused and Yeah, like things like RWA, which, you know, there's craft sessions that are really, really helpful. But a lot of that is networking and meeting people and other stuff. So this is my craft thing. And one of the taglines of it was level up your craft, which I think is super, you know, makes sense. That's kind of what I was there for. But I see this in a lot of events and writer communities, especially when there's a person who is teaching who has a lot of knowledge to share, like Sean Coyne. I've seen this with Margie Lawson, who I took her immersion class, which is a 3-day class, 5 days. I don't know. It was several days long. And I did this like 2 years ago. It's flown out of my head. But it was Margie Lawson's immersion class, which I also highly recommend. And if you've done it, you know she's amazing. But I see writers who are taking classes from people and learning from people with a lot of great information to share. I mean, these people are experts in their field and they're worthy of respect, definitely. But I see people treating them as gurus and as like they have all of the answers. And if I just do this right, you know, if I do it to that person's satisfaction, then I will have done it correctly. You know, well, what does Margie think about this? What does Sean think about this? How did I did this? And my answers on this. And I got that vibe, you know, from this event and from other things that I've been at. And that's troubling to me because I just, yes, these people have a lot to teach us. But like what I was just saying, like they're not like the king of writing, you know, or the queen of writing. And doing everything perfectly according to their system, A, is not possible because it's all subjective. And B is like, why is that your goal? You know? And I think it's a trap that a lot of people fall into when they, maybe it's just human nature. You want to find someone to follow. You want to find some kind of guru, whether it's a life coach, some sort of religious figure, a writing coach, something like that. You're searching for answers. You're searching for a way to move forward, a way to level up and get to your goals, you know, and you found someone who you think has the answers. And part of it is my natural disinclination to follow people and to be in groups, which I've talked about. And I'm always in my natural suspicion of everyone and everything. And I'm not suspicious of these people. Like, I don't think that they're doing anything to engender this. They're sharing their knowledge. They have businesses where they teach and, you know, and that's all fine. But sometimes the reaction that I have seen, and in my opinion, I feel like is dangerous. And I would just encourage people if they're working really hard to meet their goals and they find someone who they think has the answers, that person probably has something to teach you. But that doesn't mean they have all of the answers to everything and that doing it perfectly in their system is going to net you your dreams, because I just don't think it will. So that is my soapbox for today. I did have a comment on my last episode where I was talking about Carnival Row, and Charmy Sketches on YouTube left a comment about my use of the term Uncle Tom and just wishing that that term would die already, that it's an insult that people use to explain other points of view when they feel threatened or that people dare to think differently. And I thought about that, you know, and I think it's in a lot of cases, it's true. You know, the term Uncle Tom has been used about people like President Obama, you know, which I don't think is accurate. In my mind, the term refers to someone who has ideas or actions that are detrimental to their own people, in favor of their oppressor, I guess you could say. So for instance, a lot of Black Republicans will get called Uncle Toms just for being Black Republicans. And I don't think in all cases that that's true. I think that someone like Michael Steele, I personally have respect for, because I think that he comes at it from a very thoughtful perspective. Whereas someone like Clarence Thomas, and this is all my opinion, I would call an Uncle Tom, because specifically for something like opposing affirmative action when you are a recipient of affirmative action, something like that is, okay, you have the right to whatever beliefs you hold you know, opinions that you have, and you have reasons for that. But when you are the direct recipient of something that helped you, that got you to where you are, and you turn around and say, oh no, we don't need that anymore, that is holding a belief or an action that is detrimental to your people. And I don't think that's okay. And so in terms of the show, what I was trying to say is that character had opinions about, he was a Fae character, had opinions about the Fae. And I think that in the show, it was about not charging enough, like charging very low wages. And so that the humans weren't able to work. When that person had built himself up by his quote unquote bootstraps, by earning low wages, and so turn around and then say, oh no, we shouldn't do that, I thought was not okay. I thought was shady, you know? And so in the Black community, there's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of policing. There's a lot of, oh, Black people don't do this, Black people shouldn't do that, or you're acting white. And I've definitely been a recipient of that, the way I talk and all kinds of things. Like, people will say you talk white or you're acting white because you are interested in these things that aren't Black enough. And that can be equated, you know, you can be called an Uncle Tom for that. And I agree that that's ridiculous. Like, when you're using it to just say that you don't agree with what is should be the norm, that's different than actively holding your people back because of your views, you know what I mean? And I'm not sure if I'm being clear, but so I appreciated that critique. And I had to think about my own usage. Like, am I just, you know, feeding into something that I don't believe? And I don't believe that we should police Blackness. Like, if you're into punk rock, if you're into like all of these things, a lot of other Black people are into them. If you're into hockey, like whatever thing that's like quote unquote white thing that you're into, do it, be it, whatever. But like, I think it crosses a line when it starts to change into something that that is like, it's for the white gaze. And you can extrapolate this into any marginalized group and any the group that is marginalizing them, you know. So that was my response, but I appreciated the comment and, you know, gave me a lot to think about. And I had to kind of look at, am I using it too flipply? Am I being flip about it? So yeah. Writing update. At 69,000 words, I think this first fast draft is done. I might be at 70,000, but didn't quite hit the 75. At the end, I was really just zero drafting scenes, which is even less than a fast draft. It's just really a sketch because I never quite know the end. And even my normal fast drafts, the end, the last third to fourth of the book, I know is going to change based on the things that I discover when I revise the beginning. So I'm going to call this first draft done. It was done a couple of days late, but it is done, and I'm going to move into revision. So I'm going to spend the next few days looking at the scenes and probably spreadsheeting them. So each scene, and then it should be easier because I had index cards for basically every scene, which had the story grid parts on them. And so I'm going to put that in a spreadsheet and really just try to create a very detailed outline based on what I have and the new things that I figured out while I was drafting that change what I have, if that makes sense. So, and I want to do this by hand because I'm just on the computer so much. So I've done this before. I have legal paper and I just take, so it's a bigger sheet, and go across it, draw a grid by hand, and then write by hand. I think I'm going to actually print out the fast draft, even though it's super messy and dirty and I'm going to want to like fix all the typos, which I haven't. I've fixed typos in some of them because when I use the AlphaSmart, for some reason, it's just typo city. Like, I'm going fast, I'm typing fast, I don't care about spelling. I tend to mistype certain words all the time, like the word the, it's always T-H-E instead of it's always T-E-H instead of T-H-E when I'm fast drafting. But I'm going to leave the typos in, print it out, read it, so I can do the whole thing offline and have it in a different medium. And so really plan in detail the revision on paper And then hopefully by the end of the week, dive into that actual rewriting of every scene. So that is the plan. And once I get a feel for my pacing, then I will work on the schedule. But I don't want to try to constrain myself too much because I know that this is the part that takes time. And so it's just going to take as long as it takes. And hopefully that's only, let's see, October, November, December. It needs to take 3 months. It's going to take as long as it takes, but it can't take more than 3 months is basically what you should walk away with. So yeah, that is it for me for this week. Next weekend, I'm at the Brooklyn Book Festival. And so if you are in the area, please stop by. And I'll talk to you later. Happy reading. For episode show notes and to learn more about me and my books, go to lpenelope.com. Subscribe to My Imaginary Friends wherever you get your podcasts and check out the video episodes on YouTube. And please leave a rating and review to help support the show.